2010. The protesters may have opposed neoliberal policies, but they also were shaped, he argues, by neoliberal subjectivity. The Arab revolutions lacked the kind of radicalism in political and economic outlook that marked most other 20th century revolutions. Byatt writes in his book, Revolution Without Revolutionaries, Making Sense of the Arab Spring. Unlike the revolutions of the 1970s that espoused a powerful socialist, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, and social justice impulse, Arab revolutionaries were preoccupied more with the broad issues of human rights, political accountability, and legal reform. The prevailing voices, secular and Islamist alike, took free market, property relations, and neoliberal rationality for granted, an uncritical worldview that would pay only lip service to the genuine concerns of the masses for social justice and distribution. As Bevin notes, a generation of individuals raised to view everything as if it were a business enterprise was de-radicalized, came to view this global order as natural, and became unable to imagine what it takes to carry out a true revolution. The popular uprisings, as Bevin notes, did a very good job of blowing holes in social structures and creating political vacuums. But the power vacuums were swiftly filled in Egypt by the military, in Bahrain by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation Council, in Kyiv by a different set of oligarchs and well-organized militant nationalists. In Turkey, it was eventually filled by Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and in Hong Kong, it was Beijing. The horizontally structured, digitally coordinated, leaderless mass protest is fundamentally illegible, Bevins writes. You cannot gaze upon it or ask it questions and come up with a coherent interpretation based on evidence. You can assemble facts, absolutely, millions of them. You are just not going to be able to use them to construct an authoritative reading. This means that the significance of these events will be imposed upon them from the outside. In order to understand what might happen after any given protest explosion, you must not only pay attention to who is waiting in the wings to fill a power vacuum, you have to pay attention to who has the power to define the uprising itself. The lack of hierarchical structures in recent mass movements, done to prevent a leadership cult and make sure all voices are heard while noble in its aspirations, make movements easy prey. By the time Zuccotti Park, where I spent a lot of time, had hundreds of people attending general assemblies, for example, the diffusion of voices and opinions meant paralysis, especially once the movement was heavily infiltrated by police, the FBI, and Homeland Security. Peter Kropotkin makes this point, writing that consensus works in small groups, he caps the number at 150, but cripples large organizations. Revolutions require skilled organizers, self-discipline, an alternative ideological vision, revolutionary art, and education. They require sustained disruptions of power, and most importantly, leaders who represent the movement. Revolutions are long, difficult projects that take years to make, slowly and often imperceptibly eating away at the foundations of power. The successful revolutions of the past, along with their theorists, should be our guide, not the ephemeral images that entrance us on mass media. Revolution is not ultimately, as Roger said, a political calculation. It is a moral one. It is grounded in a vision of another world, another way of being. It is driven in the end by a moral imperative, especially since many of those who begin a revolution do not survive to see its fulfillment. Revolutionaries know that, as Immanuel Kant wrote, if justice perishes, human life on earth has lost its meaning. And this means that, like Socrates, we must come to a place where it is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong. We must at once see and act. And given what it means to see, this will require the surmounting of despair, not by reason, but by faith. I saw in the conflicts I covered the power of this faith. which lies outside any religious or philosophical creed. This faith is what Havel calls in his essay, the power of the powerless, living in truth. Living in truth exposes the corruption, lies, and deceit of the state. It is a refusal to be part of the charade. You do not become a dissident just because you decide one day to take up this most unusual career, Havel writes. You are thrown into it by your personal sense of responsibility, combined with a complex set of external circumstances. You are cast out of the existing structures and placed in a position of conflict with them. It begins as an attempt to do your work well and ends with being branded an enemy of society. The dissident does not operate in the realm of genuine power at all. He or she is not seeking power. He or she has no desire for office and does not gather votes. He or she does not attempt to charm the public. He or she offers nothing and promises nothing. He or she can offer, if anything, only their own skin, and they offer it solely because they have no other way of affirming the truth they stand for. Their actions simply articulate their dignity as a citizen, regardless of the cost. The long, long road of sacrifice and suffering that led to the collapse of the communist regimes stretched back decades. Those who made change possible were those who had discarded all notions of the practical. They did not try to reform the Communist Party. They did not attempt to work within the system. They did not even know what, if anything, their tiny protests, ignored by the state-controlled media, would accomplish. But through it all, they held fast to moral imperatives. They did so because these values were right and just. They expected no reward for their virtue. Indeed, they got none. They were marginalized and persecuted. And yet these dissidents, poets, playwrights, actors, singers, and writers finally triumphed over state and military power. They drew the good to the good. They triumphed because, however cowed and broken the masses around them appeared, their message of defiance did not go unheard. It did not go unseen. The steady drumbeat of rebellion constantly exposed the dead hand of authority and rot of the state. I stood with hundreds of thousands of rebellious Czechs in 1989 on a cold winter night in Prague's Venceslas Square as the singer Marta Kubashova approached the balcony of the Metternich building. Kubashova had been banished from the airwaves in 1968 after the Soviet invasion for her anthem of defiance, A Prayer for Marta. Her entire catalog, including more than 200 singles, had been confiscated and destroyed by the state. She had disappeared from public view. Her voice that night flooded the square. Pressing around me were throngs of students, many of whom had not been born when she was disappeared. They began to sing the words of the anthem. There were tears running down their faces. It was then that I understood the power of rebellion. It was then that I knew that no act of rebellion, however futile it appears in the moment, is wasted. It was then that I knew that the communist regime was finished. The people will once again decide their own fate, the crowd sang in unison with Kubashova. The walls of Prague were covered that chilly winter with posters depicting Jan Palach. Palach, a university student, set himself on fire in Venceslas Square on January 16, 1969, in the middle of the day, to protest the crushing of the country's democratic movement. He died of his burns 3 days later. The state swiftly attempted to erase his act from national memory. There was no mention of it on state media. A funeral march by university students was broken up by police. Palach's gravesite, which became a shrine, saw the communist authorities exhume his body, cremate his remains, and ship them to his mother, with the provision that his ashes could not be placed in the cemetery. But it did not work. His defiance remained a rallying cry. His sacrifice spurred the students in the winter of 1989 to act. Prague's Red Army Square, shortly after I left for Bucharest to cover the uprising in Romania, was renamed Pollock Square. 10,000 people went to the dedication. We, like those who opposed the long night of communism, no longer have any mechanisms within the formal structures of power that will protect or advance our rights. We too have undergone a corporate coup d'etat, carried out not by the stone-faced leaders of a monolithic communist party, but the corporate state. We may feel, in the face of the ruthless corporate destruction of our nation, our culture, and our ecosystem, powerless and weak, but we are not. We have a power that terrifies the corporate state. Any act of rebellion, no matter how few people show up or how heavily it is censored, chips away at corporate power. Any act of rebellion keeps alive the embers for larger movements that follow. It sustains another narrative. It will, as the state consumes itself, attract wider and wider numbers. Perhaps this will not happen in our lifetimes, but if we persist, we will keep this possibility alive. If we do not, it will die. Reinhold Niebuhr labeled this capacity to defy the forces of repression a sublime madness in the soul. Niebuhr wrote that nothing but madness will do battle with malignant power and spiritual wickedness in high places. This sublime madness, as Niebuhr understood, is dangerous, but it is vital. Without it, truth is obscured. And Niebuhr also knew that traditional liberalism was a useless force in moments of extremity. Liberalism, Niebuhr wrote, lacks the spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. It is too intellectual and too little emotional to be an efficient force in history. The prophets in the Hebrew Bible had this sublime madness. The words of the Hebrew prophets, as Rabbi Abraham Heschel wrote, were a scream in the night. While the world is at ease and asleep, the prophet feels the blast from heaven. The prophet, because he or she saw and faced an unpleasant reality, was, as Heschel wrote, compelled to proclaim the very opposite of what his or her heart expected. This sublime madness is essential. It is the acceptance that when you stand with the oppressed, you will be treated like the oppressed. It is the acceptance that although empirically all that we have struggled to achieve during our lifetime may be worse, our struggle validates itself. As Hannah Arendt writes in The Origins of Totalitarianism, the only morally reliable people are not those who say this is wrong or this should not be done, but those who say, I can't. Karl Popper in The Open Society and Its Enemies writes that the question is not how do you get good people to rule. Popper says this is the wrong question. Most people attracted to power, he writes, have rarely been above average, either morally or intellectually, and often been below it. The question is how do we build forces to restrict the despotism of the powerful? There is a moment in Henry Kissinger's memoirs, do not buy the book, when Nixon and Kissinger are looking out at tens of thousands of anti-war protesters who have surrounded the White House. The Nixon administration had placed empty city buses in a ring around the White House to keep the protesters back. Nixon looked out the window and said to Kissinger, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. And that is exactly where we want people in power to be. And this is why, although he was not a liberal, Nixon was our last liberal president. He was scared of movements. And if we cannot make the elite scared of us, we will fail. We must build organized structures of open defiance. It may take years. But without a potent counterweight, without an alternative vision, and alternative structures of self-rule, we will be steadily disempowered. Every action we take, every word we utter, must make it clear that we refuse to participate in our own enslavement and our own destruction. And courage is contagious. Revolutions begin, as I saw in East Germany, with a few Lutheran clergy holding candles as they marched through the streets of Leipzig. It ends with 500,000 people protesting in East Berlin, the defection of the police and the army to the side of the protesters, and the collapse of the Stasi state. But revolutions only happen when a few dissidents decide they will no longer cooperate. We may not succeed, so be it. At least those who come after us, and I speak as a father, will say we tried. The corporate forces that have us in their death grip will destroy our lives. They will destroy the lives of my children. They will destroy the lives of your children. They will destroy the ecosystem that makes life possible. We owe it to those who come after us not to be complicit in this evil. We owe it to them to refuse to be good Germans. And in the end, I do not fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. Thank you.
Chris Hedges, a wise owl if ever I saw one, political commentator, journalist, writer, and host of the inimitable Chris Hedges Report, joins me now from the United States. Chris, this is, it feels to me, a momentous evening. The scale and nature of the Israeli terrorist attack on Lebanon is likely to be a spark that brings the much-discussed wider war in the Middle East, at least according to me. What about you?
Yes, and it follows a pattern. So if you know the history of Gaza as well as I do, but there would be an uneasy ceasefire, and Israel would break the ceasefire and carry out provocations that they knew would elicit a response by Hamas and other resistance groups. And we're seeing the same pattern here. Remember that these explosions came a day after the Israeli cabinet released a decision that a priority now was to return Israelis to the north. About 80,000 have been displaced. There have been reports in the Israeli press that there are disputes between the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, over a war in Lebanon. And then there have been rumors that Netanyahu will even dismiss Gallant and replace him with the far-right politician, Gideon Sarar. On Monday, commander of the Israeli Northern Front recommended that the government conduct an offensive to create a buffer zone within the Lebanese southern Lebanon, and this takes place, of course, a month after Hezbollah launched a drone or rocket attack that targeted Israel's military intelligence headquarters near Tel Aviv. That attack was in retaliation for Israel's assassination of the top Hezbollah commander, Fahud Shakar, and this was in late July in Beirut. That assassination took place the next day. There was an assassination of Hamas's Politburo chief, Ismail Haniyeh. So we've now watched for several weeks these provocations by Israel. Israel knows very well that those provocations demand a response. But I think you're right. What we're seeing now is at a whole other level, talking about thousands of people. And remember, many of these people are not Hezbollah fighters. They may work for Hezbollah, but they work often in civilian infrastructure. These things were going off, exploding in supermarkets while people were driving cars. It killed children. Then, of course, today now we've had apparently walkie-talkies. So, yes, Israel provokes on purpose. This is a massive provocation. All signs are that there will be an incursion by Israeli forces into southern Lebanon, perhaps even once again a bombing of Beirut. You know, this fits the pattern, both in terms of Israel's long animosity towards Hezbollah and Lebanon, but also its animosity towards the Palestinians in Gaza. But the consequences of this could be catastrophic. So, yeah, I'm with you. I'm terrified for what comes next.
An Israeli incursion, as you put it, invasion, I said, will be, of course, hotly contested. The Lebanese resistance is very strong and numerous and with a quite awesome firepower, according to Israeli sources themselves, quite apart from the fact they have powerful friends around the region. It is possible that an Israeli invasion of Lebanon could be their bloodiest ever, costliest ever incursion, invasion into an Arab country.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, both Iran and Hezbollah have actually acted up until now with amazing restraint. But yes, and it's interesting that the Israeli press reports are saying that Israeli Ministry of Transportation officials are preparing for a potential attack on the port of Haifa and Ben Gurion Airport. That, of course, is something that we have not seen, something that that would really begin to shut down the ability of Israel to operate. But I think the fact that Israeli officials are expecting something of that magnitude buttresses your point, that this will be conducted at a level that we haven't yet seen. No, I don't think that Israel's success with an incursion is in any way assured. Hezbollah is not Hamas. Hamas's rockets, I mean, to be fair, are largely ineffectual, very small compared to the missile systems provided by Iran, of course, that Hezbollah possesses. So yes, if Hezbollah decides to go all out, then I think that the possibility of this ending very badly for Israel is likely.
Now, my government has been active on social media today. Ironically, on one of them I just saw, the Foreign Office said that they stood four square with the United States against cybercrime and hacking of electronic equipment. But they've been busy on other things, large and small. But none of the British government ministers have found a single word of condemnation of what by any measure is a terrorist attack, pregnant with the possibility that others will now copy it, others with whom they're less chummy will now copy it. Is it the same in the US?
Yes. The irony is that you have that US mediator, Hochstein, who's in Israel right now, I think, attempting, well, according to the State Department, to diffuse tensions between Israel and Hezbollah. Well, you're not going to diffuse tensions between Israel and Hezbollah when over the last 2 days you've had thousands of people wounded, many quite seriously, many civilians. This is also fits this kind of pattern of Israel essentially running rogue, doing anything it wants, and the U.S., because of the Zionist lobby, which owns Congress, essentially being unable to curb the most rapacious and aggressive behavior by Israel, which, and of course, Israel expects that should it get into trouble with Iran, the United States will militarily intervene on its side. And they may not be wrong. I mean, Netanyahu has long tried to drag the United States into a conflict with Iran, just like the Israeli government dragged the United States into the Iraq war. That was a Zionist neoliberal or neoconservative project, which didn't end well for the United States, but managed to essentially break the one regional power that posed a serious threat to Israel, and that was the Iraqi regime under Saddam Hussein. So it served Israel's interests. It did not serve the interests of the United States, certainly not the interests within the region. There's the consequences of this regionally for the United States, and maybe ultimately for Israel, are deeply distressing.
Now, it turns out to have been quite a simple affair. The only barrier, really, is whether you would do such a thing, not whether you could do such a thing. Motorola say they're completely innocent. They sold a license to what turned out to be a shell company in Hungary using a Middle East bank, intriguingly. That company then produced Motorola goods, except they were filled with explosive. Anybody could do that, Chris, couldn't they? And now, almost certainly, they will.
Yeah, of course. It becomes another template. I think, there's no question this is an act of terrorism, state terrorism on the part of Israel. But yes, of course, once you begin to employ these acts of terror, you get copycat terror. I mean, remember, this is a few years ago, but I think it was ISIS captured a Jordanian pilot. And what did they do? They put the pilot in a cage and burned him alive, because that's what, of course, Jordanian and American and NATO planes were doing to them. Go all the way back to 9/11. The hijackers of 9/11 speak the language that we taught them, which was massive explosions and death above a city skyline. We've been doing it since Vietnam, when Robert McNamara called the massive bombing campaign, the Christmas bombing campaign of North Vietnam, a way to, quote-unquote, send a message to Hanoi. So I think you make an extremely important point that the atrocities we carry out are then often visited upon us. I think that you're right. This is down the road. This will be something that will be visited on Israel and perhaps its allies.
They may have done it before, of course. I've been deeply skeptical about the helicopter crash that murdered the president of Iran and the foreign minister of Iran. I'm wondering if they had a pager or a Motorola radio in the helicopter.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Remember that, going back to the so-called bomb maker in Gaza, they were doing this with cell phones, which is why resistance groups switched away from the cell phones, not only because they were tracking devices and you could be monitored, but because we had already seen Israel use mobile devices or turn mobile devices into explosives.
What do you think the implications are for the electronics industry of all this? I posited in my introductory remarks that if you lived in the global south, if you lived in a country that the United States and the United Kingdom had bad relations with or even designated as an enemy, you'd have to be a fool to be carrying around Western technology in your pocket or in your car. Am I right?
Yeah, of course. Of course. And especially because there will be no accountability. You can be sure of that. I think it's just one more step, which we have seen in this kind of multipolar universe, and we can begin with all of the sanctions against Russia, you have seen a stepping away from that Western hegemony, not only within the banking system, but within the technology sector. So, yeah, I think this is one more step in the fragmentation of the world. I mean, why? That's a, you raise a completely legitimate point. Why could you ever trust these companies again? Especially as I cannot stress enough the fact that they, nobody will be held, Israel, which